So your test is in just under 2 days. You need to bring a answer form for that. I'm going to use the burgundy ones, which technically aren't Scantrons, but whatever company it is. You know which ones I'm talking about, the narrow burgundy ones, not the full sheets. So how many of you are going to forget to do that? I won't have any, so hopefully the responsible students will bring more than one and we'll have enough for everyone. But try to remember that. That means all we need to do today is finish up chapter 4, which is about how amino acids get arranged into polypeptides and proteins. We made it up to slide 14, and I haven't talked about this yet, but this is another part of secondary structure. We were talking about alpha helices before. This is not an alpha helix, though, or part of an alpha helix. This is a beta strand, and it's part of a secondary structure that we call a beta pleated sheet, or just a beta sheet. This is not a sheet, though. This is just a strand. A sheet is several strands arranged side by side, in parallel, in other words. The 7 angstrom measurement here is greater than you would find for corresponding residues in an alpha helix. And that's because a beta strand is much more extended. An alpha helix is a pretty compact structure. These residues are more extended, and then when you get several of these beta strands next to each other, they can hydrogen bond to each other, and that's what forms the overall beta sheet, which is exactly what you see happening in slide 15. Neither A nor B here is a complete beta sheet, but now you can see the association between adjacent beta strands. And the main point of this slide is to show you that that association between adjacent beta strands within one beta sheet can occur either in a parallel fashion or an anti-parallel fashion. That's the difference between A and B. A has an anti-parallel arrangement because remember that any sequence of amino acids has directionality to it, right? Going from amino to carboxyl end. And so the anti-parallel arrangement between two adjacent beta strands simply means that one is going amino to carboxyl in one direction and the other one is going to from amino to carboxyl in the other direction, indicated by the yellow arrows here. And if you have an anti-parallel arrangement, what's shown by the hashed boxes is that you have hydrogen bonding in a one-to-one correspondence between residues, a residue in one strand and a single residue in the other strand. Now, do you recognize each box as a single residue? Can you orient yourself and see which carbon is the alpha carbon? Okay, I believe you. In a parallel arrangement, as you see in B, they're both going in the same direction. Now, these are part of the same overall polypeptide. So obviously there is some stretch of amino acids that we're not seeing here that connects these two beta strands together. But the strands themselves are just a subset of the overall polypeptide. Each individual strand is. There's several strands in a polypeptide. And they come together either by looping back around so they're going the same direction or looping, making a turn so that they're going in opposite directions. That's the difference between parallel and anti-parallel. And what you see on the boxes in B is that if it's a parallel arrangement, which is what this is, then the hydrogen bonding is a little bit different. A residue in one strand forms hydrogen bonds with two separate residues in the other strand. That's what the boxes are representing there. Well, that is just a single pair. We were looking at in both A and B at just one pair of beta strands in an overall sheet. An overall sheet is usually many strands, but each beta sheet you can break down into individual pairs, and the relationship within that pair is either parallel or antiparallel. But that's not to say that the entire sheet is necessarily all antiparallel or all parallel. There can be mixed beta sheets, like you see part of right here. This is a parallel arrangement between these two. This is an antiparallel arrangement between these two. It just depends on the individual protein overall. So this is a mixed sheet. Okay, 17 is a typical rendering or representation of a beta sheet. Each individual beta strand in this depiction is represented by an arrow so that you see its directionality. And all we're seeing here are just the beta strands, not the sequences of amino acids that are there, of course, holding these strands together. So these strands are not individual polypeptides. They're just the only thing being represented here. In the overall polypeptide, you would have sequences joining end-to-end each strand of that sheet. And another bit of information that you see in this rendering is that even though it's possible for some beta sheets to be almost planar, they all lie almost within the same plane, each strand. Typically what you have is that each strand is slightly rotated with respect to its adjacent strand, and therefore the overall sheet, like you see on this end view in B, has a twisted shape to it. But the width of the overall sheet, by which I mean however many strands side by side make it up, is also a variable thing depending on what the protein is. You typically see beta sheets in globular proteins, and we're looking at an example of a globular protein in slide 18. I think I mentioned that based on shape, you can roughly classify any given protein as being either globular or fibrous, right? Globular proteins have a greater variety of functions. For instance, enzymes are globular, transport proteins are globular. The fibrous proteins are usually for structural, have a structural function. They act like little ropes or cables. But globular proteins, being more compact, have a more intricate shape possible in their conformation, and therefore can do all kinds of jobs, like being receptors, being enzymes, like I said, and so on. And that's typically where you'll see beta sheets, just like in this. This happens, this doesn't really matter what the example is, but this happens to be a fatty acid binding protein. So it's something that binds something. Well, things that bind other things have to have a certain shape, and you usually see that in a globular protein. But notice that now you don't see just the arrows. This ribbon model shows you not only the directionality of each individual beta strand and the overall arrangement of the entire beta sheet, but it shows you that that beta sheet is part of just one entire polypeptide in this example. There's a continuous sequence of amino acids from one end of this ribbon to the other. And there's also an alpha helix thrown in there for good measure. Okay, let's go to 19. Alpha helices and beta sheets are the largest components of secondary structure. And they're also the most uniform. I mean, alpha helices can differ from each other, for instance, in their length. You have different lengths of alpha helices, and even if you had two alpha helices of the same length, the R groups that hang off of that alpha helix can differ from helix to helix. So not all alpha helices are completely consistent, but as far as their shape is concerned, They're very similar to each other. And same is true for beta sheets. But hooking them together, alpha helices to each other, beta strands to each other, and alpha helices to beta sheets, are these sequences of amino acids that have a more variable arrangement to them, which are represented by the magenta coloring, well, and yellow on the bottom. The stuff other than the arrows here in this. We include in the secondary structure, though, things called loops and turns. Loops and turns are fairly short sequences of amino acids that loop around or turn, and they're usually called reverse turns. This is exactly how you have an anti-parallel beta sheet. A reverse turn, like you see in magenta here, will allow two adjacent beta strands to be in opposite directions. But it also, these loops and turns, since they make turns, this is how a typical globular protein comes to be globular, right? A fibrous protein just keeps going in the same direction, more or less. A globular protein has to make a bunch of reversals. And so those reverse turns and loops are also considered part of secondary structure. And it makes sense that they're part of secondary structure because secondary structure is about bonding, mostly hydrogen bonding, but non-covalent bonding between residues that are fairly close to each other in the overall sequence, right? Just like in an alpha helix or a beta strand. Well, also here in this reverse turn that you see schematized in part A. The I here just means it's just an ordering device. If this is the ith residue, then three residues down you have hydrogen bonding between the ith and the ith plus three to make this actual turn. That's what stabilizes the shape of that turn. So just like in alpha helices and beta pleated sheets, it's a relationship between not really distant residues that happen to come together, but fairly close, not necessarily adjacent, but fairly close within the sequence. 20 is a picture of a fibrous protein, obviously, or just part of it. It's not necessarily the entire length. And the ribbon model on part B is really better at looking at what's happening here. They represent the same example, but space-filling model doesn't really give you as much information, I don't think. The ribbon model shows you that this is not only a fibrous protein, but that it's two different polypeptides, each of which is helical, right? So you have this in a lot of structural fibrous proteins like keratin, for instance, which you have a lot of keratin in your skin and in your nails and in your hooves, if you have hooves. This is each individual helix here, the blue or the pink, is a right-hand helix. And then you get two of these right-hand helices twisted together in a left-handed superhelix. So this is an example of what's called a coiled coil, because it's two coils already that are coiled together with respect to each other. Coiled coil structures give a lot of strength, and that's what you need usually in a fibrous protein. You need strength for it to act as a structural element. All right, so 21 now. Here we're looking at collagen, which is also a much used protein in animals. You have this in all kinds of places in your body, as do other animals. And notice it is a three-part protein, three different polypeptides coming together and hydrogen bonded, which is what's represented by the dotted lines here, when you look at it on the end view. The three individual polypeptides, each in its own color here, are held together pretty compactly. you look at the end view, there isn't very much space in here. And notice that there are three G's labeled here. What do the G's represent? Yes, glycine, which is one of the biological amino acids. The rest of the amino acids aren't labeled because glycine, there's something special about glycine, just in general, not even necessarily having to do with collagen, but it works for collagen. What is special about glycine? It is what? Yes, it's the only one that's, it's the only biological amino acid that's non-chiral. And it, why is it chiral, did you say? I mean, why is it not chiral? Because it has two hydrogens. That R group is just a hydrogen in glycine. So it's also the simplest amino acid. But since there, since any given amino acid already has a hydrogen bonded to the central carbon, having a second one bonded there means you don't have four different things on the corners, and therefore it's not chiral. There's not a right and a left-hand version. That's really not so much what the big deal is here with respect to collagen, though. The fact that glycine has as its R group just a hydrogen, which is the smallest possible thing you can connect to it, means that glycine as a side chain doesn't take up much room. And therefore, by having these glycines in every third position in each polypeptide that comes together to make up the overall collagen molecule, with the glycines facing toward the core of this three subunit rope, it allows them to come together very closely, the strands. There would be steric hindrance if there were any other side chain in that core, in other words. And by allowing them to come together close enough, that means the hydrogen bonds can form and hold them together. So collagen is pretty tough stuff. That's why you have a bunch of it in bone and cartilage. Okay, 22. We've been talking about secondary structure up until this point, but 22 shows you now the overall tertiary structure, just using an example molecule. This one happens to be myoglobin. And myoglobin is similar to hemoglobin, but you find it in different places. Hemoglobin is in the blood, right? And is a respiratory pigment because it carries oxygen and carbon dioxide around. Where do you find myoglobin? Right, in muscle, mostly skeletal muscle and cardiac muscle. Myo means muscle. It also is a respiratory pigment. It's able to carry oxygen because it has a heme group, just like you find multiple examples of in a single hemoglobin molecule. But anyway, myoglobin was, I think, the first protein whose tertiary structure was elucidated. And that's why this book happened to use it as an example. But the point here is something I think you already know, that tertiary structure refers to the overall three-dimensional arrangement of a single polypeptide. And myoglobin is an example of a protein consisting of just one polypeptide. And so then that's the biggest usefulness of the ribbon model. When you depict a protein as a ribbon, it shows you that it's all one sequence, has two ends, an amino end and a carboxyl end. So this is just one polypeptide, and therefore in this example, polypeptide and protein really mean the same thing, right? Because that's all there is in this protein. And it has a certain shape that allows it to operate the way it does, because the secondary structures that it has, the various helices and the loops and turns, are such that it brings this thing into a compact structure with a certain shape. Shape is everything with proteins because that's what gives any given protein its function. But especially the globular proteins. I mean, it's true of any protein, of course. The elongated shape of a collagen molecule gives it its function as well. But when it comes to the globular proteins, that peculiar surface shape is going to be just right for some certain function, whether it's binding a receptor or allowing something to go through the membrane, all kinds of things, a substrate onto an enzyme. It's all about shape. All right, now in 23, we're looking at the same molecule, but what we see here is not so much the specific secondary structure shapes, the helices and turns, but different colors to represent the either the charge or the polarity of the residues. And the blue spheres represent charged residues. So they are either positive or negative. Whereas the yellow ones are hydrophobic. And really the main point of this whole picture is that something that's true in general of polypeptides that have folded into their tertiary structure. And namely, that is that tertiary structure comes about because of all these non-covalent interactions that we've been talking about, and also covalent interactions in the case of disulfide bonds, but mostly non-covalent interactions occurring between residues that happen to be brought into juxtaposition. And whether a residue is charged or not, or polar or nonpolar, is going to determine where it's going to end up in the overall shape. Because of the hydrophobic effect, hydrophobic residues are not going to be found very much on the surface. Some are, but the vast majority of the hydrophobic residues are going to, in most cases, seek the interior of the overall glob so that they are away from the water, right? And the water has no problem being around the polar groups or the fully charged groups, which is why you find those residues in blue on the surface. The difference between A and B here is the same molecule, but A is the entire molecule and B is a cutaway. So we're looking at the core here, and that's why it's so yellow. This is the inside of this. It would be coated by a bunch of blues if we looked at all of it. And this is how a polypeptide that has just been translated at a ribosome, a brand new polypeptide, this is how it knows, in a sense, how to fold up into the correct shape to have its proper function. Any given polypeptide, especially if you have a decently long polypeptide, many amino acids, is going to have obviously more than one possible way that it could fold up in three dimensions. And you don't, I mean, if you do the math, you see that there's actually a ridiculously large number of possibilities. If you considered them all to be equally possible, proteins would almost never fold into the correct shape. So why are they able to find their correct shape? Because you can think of each possible shape as having a stability level. And you know, you can think of it as being a high energy or a low energy situation. And the low energy configuration is going to be more naturally attained, right? There's going to be one, usually, that is the lowest energy. And that's the one that usually gets folded in. I mean, that's what it usually gets folded into. That's the correct shape. Sometimes, though, well, I shouldn't say sometimes. Usually the local chemistry, the immediate surroundings of that still folding protein, is going to influence some of those interactions. And so if a polypeptide is just left on its own in the cytosol, exposed to the general cytosol, it might end up folding into a shape that's not correct for its function. And this happens, actually, to a certain extent all the time. Proteins are misfold all the time to some level in your cells. And when that happens, they just are usually scrapped. They're dismantled. The amino acids are used for building blocks, and you start over. You go back to the gene and start over and make a brand new one. But usually they do fold properly. Sometimes they fold properly just on their own in the cytosol, but sometimes that proper folding requires the help of still other proteins that kind of keep the folding protein from interacting with the immediate surroundings, at least temporarily, so that it can form the correct non-covalent interactions that give it its proper shape. And we call those kinds of proteins that help that folding process chaperone proteins. Chaperone proteins allow for proper folding in most cases of proteins to give them their proper tertiary structure. All right, now, in 24, what we're looking at is a motif, what we call a motif. A motif is some repeating theme. That's just generally what the word means. But biochemically, a motif refers to certain patterns that we see over and over in many different kinds of proteins, like the helix turn helix, which is pretty self-descriptive. It's a helix with a turn and then another helix. Well, that specific combination of these secondary structures gives that part of the molecule a certain function. And therefore, we classify that as a motif. A helix turn helix is just an example of a motif. There are other kinds as well. It's just an example. But motifs are a little bit like functional groups in that they give that specific protein the ability to do something based on that specific motif. These are kind of small scale in terms of the overall size of the protein, though. Motifs are not real large. A similar thing, though, but larger in scope, are what are shown in slide 25, and these are called domains. Really the same thing happening here, but you're talking about a bigger chunk of the overall polypeptide when you're talking about domains. Also, a distinction is that domains are usually relatively compact parts of an overall polypeptide, and notice that we have just one polypeptide here. The four colors are just different domains of the one polypeptide shown. And each colored part, each domain, is like its own mini globular protein in a sense, except that it's not its own protein. And then connecting the different domains are more flexible regions. The amino acid sequences that hook the domains together can bend more than the shape of each domain can. But the point is the same as it is for motifs. Each domain, because of its shape, is giving that protein a certain function. And therefore, they act like large functional groups. You see similar domains in totally different proteins as well. So, I mean, that's why two different proteins, which have a different overall job, might do one part of that job exactly the same as the other protein, because it shares a domain. Even though the overall polypeptide is not the same, if a domain is the same, then it can do the same type of thing, just like a functional group allows things to happen. All right. Oh, by the let me just, while I'm still at domains, say that it's also true that, well, remember learning about alternative splicing with respect to introns and exons? Remember learning about this? What's this allow an organism to do? Right, but even in more general terms, it allows a single gene to code for multiple polypeptides, right? Depending on which exons and introns are, depending on which sequences are considered to be introns and exons, you're going to end up making a different sequence of amino acid because you're going to make actually different versions of the mature mRNA. Even though you start out with the same mRNA transcript, the pre-mRNA, by splicing it differently, you're going to end up with different versions of mRNA from that same gene. And sometimes what that really involves is, okay, this time around I'm going to include this domain. Another time around I won't include that domain, but the rest of it will be basically the same. And so, and that's why when we're talking about multiple proteins being coded for by the same protein, it's not the case that you have a protein doing, or two proteins doing totally different jobs being coded for by the same gene. It's usually a family of proteins, all with a similar function, but under slightly different optimal conditions, like isozymes, right? Isozymes are different versions of an enzyme that does the same job, catalyzes the same reaction, but they work at slightly different optimal temperatures or pHs, and that can be accomplished sometimes just by including or excluding domains. All right, let's go to 26 and talk about quaternary structure, which you can also pronounce quaternary. Either one is fine. Quaternary structure refers to the three-dimensional arrangement of multiple polypeptides. And so keep in mind that this does not apply to all proteins. The only proteins that have quaternary structure are multimeric proteins, which is just a word that indicates that kind of protein is made of at least two polypeptides that remain as individual polypeptides, right? You don't link the two polypeptides covalently end to end, because if you did that, you would just have one bigger polypeptide and it wouldn't be a multimeric protein. So the constituent polypeptides in a multimeric protein remain as individual polypeptides, and in a ribbon model like this one, each individual subunit, as they're called, will have two ends, an amino end and a carboxyl end. But then there's going to be some sort of either covalent or non-covalent or both interaction between the constituent subunits to make the overall quaternary protein. And this example is just one possibility, one way this can happen. What you have here is the simplest possibility, in a sense, because it's simplest for a couple reasons. One is that there's just two, which is the bare minimum number of subunits you need to have it be quaternary, right? It's also the simplest because those two subunits are the same subunits, just two copies of it. Okay? So if we have a multimeric protein that is made of exactly two subunits, whether they're the same or not, we call that thing a dimer, literally a two-parter, right? Mer means part, just as in polymer means many part. So this is a dimer, but you can further classify any given dimer or trimer or tetramer, whatever, however many subunits there are. You can further classify them based on whether their subunits are identical or non-identical. And since, and if we have a dimer like this one where it's two copies of the same subunit, we call that a homodimer. If you have one subunit and a totally different subunit come together for a dimer, then we call that a heterodimer. And similarly, you can have homotetramers, heterotetramers, and so on. Can get pretty complex, and there's a lot of dimers, but there's also very large protein complexes that are can be dozens of subunits that are different from each other, and that's when you start getting into these molecular machines that do pretty complex work. What are we looking at in 27? Anyone know which specific example this is? Well, the giveaway hint is that each of these four gray areas is a heme. So this is hemoglobin, yeah. Hemoglobin and myoglobin are found in different places, like we were saying earlier, but it's also a major difference is that myoglobin is just a single subunit protein. It doesn't have quaternary structure, whereas hemoglobin is a multimeric protein. And so, how would you classify hemoglobin based on the words I just gave you? What is it?
Tetramer.
It is a tetramer, and more specifically, what kind of tetramer? It's a tetramer because there are four overall subunits. Tetra means four. Maybe it's not obvious from the ribbon model, but the reason that there are two colors being used here is that the different colors represent different kinds of polypeptides. So there are four overall globin subunits. Each subunit in this case is called a globin. But there are two different kinds of globin being used, which are alpha and beta, just A and B. It's a tetramer, but there are two alphas and two betas. And therefore, it is a heterotetramer, right? Because there's more than just one type of polypeptide. And specifically, you could the most information you could give is to say that it's alpha sub 2, beta sub 2. That means that there's two of each of those alphas and betas. That gives you more information. But the point here is just that it's a good example of a quaternary protein. All right, now 28 obviously is a sequence of amino acids. And so even though this thing is drawn just in one plane, that's just for simplicity. Notice that the amino terminus and the carboxyl terminus are explicitly labeled here to show you that this is just one polypeptide. So this thing isn't a quaternary protein. But also notice in the colored parts that you have a particularly good stability to the overall shape of this protein because of the existence of disulfide bonds. What are the Cs? Cysteine residues, exactly. And cysteine residues are able to take part in disulfide bonds because what does each cysteine have? A sulfhydryl as part of its R group. What is a sulfhydryl? SH, right. Okay, so those are particularly strong bonds because they're covalent, but you also have all the other non-covalent interactions we're talking about to give this thing its overall shape. And what else did I want to say about this? Well, I guess nothing for that slide. In 29, though, we're looking at the same protein that was denatured. Denaturation refers to the loss of proper conformation, right? Loss of shape. And in this case, this is done chemically. Denaturation is being done chemically by a very strong solution of urea and some beta mercaptan ethanol. These chemicals disrupt these interactions that we've been talking about that hold together the three-dimensional shape. It's relatively easy to disrupt the non-covalent bonds, but you can also even break the covalent bonds, turning these things back into sulfhydryls. What chemical process would that be if you're turning these covalent disulfide bonds, sulfur-sulfur, into individual SHs? Who said reduction? Yeah, that's right. Right? You're adding a hydrogen to them. That's reducing it. You're adding an electron in the form of a hydrogen atom. Just the opposite of when you pick off a hydrogen, which is typically done for fuels. This is how you get energy from the food you eat, right? You pick those hydrogens off, that's oxidation. This is adding them to it, so it's reduction. Anyway, though, the point here is that all of these various interactions that gives it its three-dimensional shape are disrupted, and therefore you have a denatured enzyme in this case, but a protein in general. And I think it was last meeting I said that in the process of gene expression, which includes transcription and translation, translation is the last informational step. I said that the information required for proper three-dimensional structure is already present in that primary sequence, in that specific sequence of amino acids. And that comes, of course, from the information that's encoded in the messenger RNA. So as long as you make that proper sequence of amino acids, that polypeptide already has inherent in itself information necessary to go into a specific three-dimensional shape based on these interactions we've been talking about. Well, the first time that was really demonstrated experimentally was with this example protein that we're looking at. So it was denatured in vitro, so not in cells, it's just in test tubes, and then renatured by restoring the proper chemical environment. The thing actually went back into its proper shape just because of the information that's contained in its primary sequence and because of the fact that it's going to seek the lowest energy possibility. Well, that happens for some proteins, like this one. But there are other proteins that once denatured or denatured to a critical level are not going to be able to renature. And this is, by the way, the same reason why, you know, when you, if you cook protein, if you cook meat, which is rich in protein, it's going to have a totally different texture, right? Which is why people cook it, to eat it. And that's because you're denaturing a hell of a lot of proteins when you drastically change the temperature. Well, if you decide you don't want that steak right now, you don't just let it cool back to room temperature. It's not going to turn into a raw steak again. It's not going to renature. Those are permanently denatured proteins. So this also tells you that what I told you a moment ago, that attaining that proper shape, even though the information for that is in the primary sequence, doesn't necessarily mean it's going to happen without any help. And in a living cell, you have the help of those chaperone proteins to make sure that it does attain that proper shape. Well, and I think this is the last slide. In slide 30, you have an example of a protein that can exist in either of two very drastically different forms, with drastically different functions. Notice that this alpha helix gets eliminated if you go into the blue version. And these things interact with entirely different molecules and therefore do different functions. Now, this is not the norm. Usually any given polypeptide is going to have one specific low-energy conformation that is the proper one for its particular function in that organism. But sometimes you can have a protein that can be in either form because on energetic grounds there are multiple possible conformations that are about the same energy level, and therefore it's not a big deal to go back and forth between either one. Okay? And we didn't think this happened at all originally, but once we've discovered these, we've, just like any other breakthrough in science, you start finding all kinds of other examples of this. But that explains why you can have drastically different shapes. It's because they're both about the same energy level, and therefore, just with the background thermal noise that's in a cell, even though one might be very slightly higher energy, you have the energy to kick it into either form, just thermally. And that is it. So I have to find some way to speak for 30 minutes. Or we could just adjourn. Don't forget your, whatever they're called, answer form.